And we're back. We're talking. Going to be talking in just a moment to George Mashke. George Mashke is the creator of antipolygraph.com. He has written a free ebook on antipolygraph.com, which I would urge you to take a look at. I have read it. It's called The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, and it is going to really blow your mind. At least it certainly blew my mind. And in a few minutes, we're going to find out exactly why. My website is unknowncountry.com, and my radio show, an internet radio show, is Dreamland. This is Art Bell and Ramona Bell's original Dreamland. We've been doing it for now 11 years since I took it over from Art and Ramona. It's still going strong. This week on Dreamland, the theme is what we are not being told. Linda Moulton Howe has a report about that asteroid that passed between Earth and the Moon on November the 8th. It was described as having some very unusual features on it. So, why haven't the images been released? Have you seen the supposedly detailed radar images of these unusual features? Well, neither have I, neither has Linda, and she's mighty curious about why not. She asks one of the principal scientists on this project some hard questions on this weekend's Dreamland. Then we have an incredible story about a missile launch near Phoenix that would be hard to believe if there wasn't video of it. This missile launch occurred last May, and the individual who made that video does a lot of research in the area, on the ground research in the area, and has followed up. It is quite a story. Dreamland is available free on unknowncountry.com for 1 week. Subscribers can listen to Jim Mars's report from last May about the missile that was seen off the coast of Los Angeles. Remember, within about a month, there were three missiles that appeared, one off the coast of Los Angeles, debunked as an aircraft contrail, turned out not to be true, one in the Gulf of Mexico, practically unreported except in local media, and this one in Phoenix, flying over a populated area, very extraordinary. It appears to be, in the video, intercepted by another object which appears to impact this missile. It's an extraordinary story. Don't miss this week's Dreamland. A lot is going on in this world that we are not being told. Now, when we get back, we're going into another world. It's a very important world and a very important part of this program because you bet your life. You bet your life every day on the polygraph working. So watch out. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber sitting in tonight for George Noory. I have tonight with me George Mashke. George is a former U.S. Army interrogator and intelligence officer with a background in counterterrorism. He holds a doctoral degree in Near Eastern languages and cultures from the University of California at Los Angeles. His experience of being falsely accused of deception during a pre-employment polygraph examination with the FBI led him to co-found antipolygraph.org, a nonprofit public interest website dedicated to exposing and ending polygraph-related waste, fraud, and abuse. I would suggest, just before we start, that the polygraph is among the most dangerous devices on planet Earth. And I'm sure, George, that you know exactly why I say that. George, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you now, and
Okay, good.
I agree, it is indeed dangerous.
And this is because 850,000 people in the United States hold security clearances. And George, are most of them vetted with the polygraph?
You know, I don't think they are, because a lot of people just have, there are three different basic levels of clearances: confidential, secret, and top secret. And then within top secret, there are higher echelons of clearance to like what's called special compartmented information. So it's really just at the top levels, typically, where polygraphs are required. Lots of people with secret clearances or top secret collateral clearances are not required to take polygraphs. But at the higher levels, for example, everyone who works for the NSA, everyone who works for the CIA, has to take a polygraph test.
So you're telling me that the people in the most important and most sensitive positions are the ones who take polygraphs, not the whole 850,000.
Yes, which is scary because polygraphs are notoriously unreliable.
Well, exactly.
At some length. So it's sort of absurd that to use this unreliable technology only for the most sensitive positions.
You're an angry man. I can see that on your website and in your biography. You mention that you were falsely accused of deception during a polygraph examination. Could you tell us what happened?
Yeah, sure. I applied to be an FBI special agent, and for a little background, I should mention at the time, I was a reserve officer in the U.S. Army in the intelligence branch, and I had done work with the FBI on two occasions during the first Persian Gulf War. I had worked with the Joint Terrorist Task Force in Washington, D.C., and then again after the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, I was called to active duty to support the investigation of that bombing, and during which I translated manuals, documents that were taken from the accused in that case. And that experience of working with the FBI in two different counterintelligence, counterterrorism investigations made me think that I'd like to make a career in the FBI working in counterterrorism. So I applied to become an FBI special agent. I also had two letters of appreciation from two different directors of the FBI. The FBI seemed actively interested in hiring me. In fact, I applied to be a special agent. They wanted me to come on right away to be a linguist, as I spoke both Arabic and Persian. So I go into the polygraph, and the polygrapher was very nice and professional, and or at least certainly seemed that way. But he ended up accusing me of deception regarding having ever disclosed classified information to unauthorized persons, of having unauthorized contacts with a foreign government, and
in effect, he accused you of being a spy.
He directed me to seek FBI employment. Yeah. I mean, you put those things together. Basically, he was accusing me of being a spy in so many words. That's the implication.
So your skills were lost to the FBI.
That is correct, right? Because if you fail an FBI pre-employment polygraph, you're barred for life from ever working with the FBI.
Now, what is a polygraph test exactly, George?
Okay, well, that's a good thing, because it was this experience of being falsely accused of deception that led me to research it, because, you know, my polygraph examiner told me that these things are 98% accurate. So I was very curious as to how I ended up being in part of the 2% margin of error. So I was a graduate student at UCLA at the time. I went to the research library and read everything I could find about polygraphs. And what I discovered really shocked me. And the key resource that I would recommend to any listeners to check out if they want to know more about lie detectors is the late David T. Licken's book, A Tremor in the Blood, Uses and Abuses of the Lie Detector. Professor Licken was a professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota, and he did a great deal of research, had a considerable interest in polygraphs, and he wrote the seminal work on that, which is A Tremor in the Blood, first published in 1981. And it turns out that the polygraph is basically junk science. It purports to detect deception, but it really doesn't. You think about it, the claim that someone can tell whether or not another person is lying, it's really a task in mind reading. And so that's a science, mind reading, that has yet to be developed. No one can do it, and it certainly can't be done with the polygraph. In fact, the polygraph test actually depends on the polygraph operator lying to and otherwise deceiving the person who's being tested.
Now, why is that true?
The first lie is that this device even works for detecting deception at all. It's important that the person who's being tested believe that the device can tell whether they're lying or not. It's part of an interrogation ploy. And the second thing is that the very procedure, let me explain how they make a decision whether you're lying or not. Let's suppose the question was whether you robbed the bank. And so anyone who's brought in by the police and strapped to a polygraph might react strongly when asked if they robbed the bank, even if they didn't, just because, you're in that situation, you're a suspect.
And it's a provocative, scary question.
Right, an accusatory one. So polygraph operators understand this. So they've devised what they think is a way of determining whether of compensating for that. But it depends on secrecy and deception of the person who's being tested. So what they'll ask is a series of questions that they'll compare to the ones about the bank robbery. They will say, that the sort of person who would lie to get out of trouble is the same sort of person who would rob a bank and then lie about it. And people who have a history of lying tend to go on to commit crimes like bank robbery. So if I were to ask you, Whitley, did you ever lie to get out of trouble? You could say no, couldn't you?
I could not say no.
So they get you to answer no.
I've been married for 42 years. Of course I've lied to try to get out of trouble.
Sure. Well, they expect that everyone will lie to that question, okay, and answer it no, and that they'll have doubts about it. So they want to get to, in a sense, trick you into lying through these control questions, as they're called, control or comparison questions.
Right.
And then they'll compare your reaction to that question to the one about robbing the bank. So if you appear to be more nervous, if you sweat more, if your heart beats faster, if your breathing is a little more erratic, when you say no, that you've never told a lie to get out of trouble, then when you say no, I did not rob the bank, then they'll assume that you didn't rob the bank because the question about lying to get out of trouble seems to bother you more.
Now that seems very logical to me. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with it is that it's extremely simplistic. You might still be more nervous about the bank robbery and whether you're if you're in police custody being questioned about the bank robbery, you face serious jail time if you're not believed and if you're convicted. So many people will still react more strongly to the question about the more serious matter, like robbing the bank, than to the question about having lied to get out of trouble. And here's another problem with the methodology, and that is that the more honest you are, the more likely you actually are to fail the test.
Now, why is that?
In your years as a parent, you've lied to get out of trouble. So say you make that admission. what's the polygraph examiner going to do? He's not going to just rule out that question and move on to something else. He's going to ask you about instances where you've lied to get out of trouble. He'll ask you to what very sternly, what lies have you told? And so you unburden yourself and talk about what lies you've told. Then what he's going to do is to rephrase the question and try to cut off further admission. So he'll say, I'm glad you told me this, but I hope that you're not the kind of person who routinely lies. Other than what you told me, did you ever lie to get out of trouble? Or you might rephrase it, did you ever lie to get out of serious trouble? He'll eventually get you to answer that question, no. But he still expects that your answer is going to be a probable lie. So here's the problem. The more that you've unburdened yourself, the more that you've told the truth, tried to answer that question truthfully, and the more you feel at ease and relaxed when you answer it because you've told the truth, the more likely you are to fail, because it makes the basis of comparison to the relevant question, the one about robbing the bank, appear stronger by comparison.
Now, I was given, in my lifetime, three polygraph tests, all of which had to do with a book I wrote called Communion, and which had, I'm sure you know of the book, and it contained some rather extraordinary claims about close encounters with the third kind, which happened as far as I was concerned, and I passed all three tests quite easily. But what you're telling me is I could just as easily have failed. Is that right? I mean, it just seems like a matter of chance.
Yes, it is indeed. Chance is a big element of it. Another big element is the polygraph examiner's expectations. There was a famous CBS 60 Minutes expose on the polygraph that aired back in 1986, in which they had a photography magazine, and they set up a scenario where they called three different polygraphers, saying that a piece of camera equipment had gone missing, and they believed that one of several employees had stolen it. And in each case, they fingered a different employee as a likely suspect. And so each polygrapher came in and polygraphed several different employees. And in each case, the one that they found deceptive was the one that had been fingered as the likely suspect beforehand. So that sort of bias, the expectation that the person is probably guilty, can certainly influence outcomes, as can the expectation that a person is truthful.
Yeah, well, in my case, they thought I was guilty. They were certain I was lying in all three of them.
When that happens, then you are indeed lucky to pass.
Right. I think I was lucky to pass because now looking back on it, I can see where, who knows what the outcome might have been. So in this case, in the 60 Minutes case, the truth was that no one had actually been deceptive because the whole thing was a setup. Is that correct?
That's correct. Nothing had been stolen. So if the polygraph really worked, everyone should have been found truthful, as no one had stolen anything.
George, this is Ann Strieber. Hi.
Hi, Ann.
I wonder if you have researched anything about body language. I know there's a science of body language revealing people's lies. For instance, there are people who watch the annual State of the Union address by the president here on mute and look for telltale signs in how they move their bodies. Do you know anything about that?
Is there anything in there?
As an interrogator, I've been exposed to that, and I have to say I'm very skeptical of it in general as being a reliable basis for inferring whether or not a person has spoken the truth.
When we get back, we're going to go deeper into this. Just how dangerous are polygraphs and the use of polygraphs to our national security? A few years ago, there was discovered within the FBI a mole who had been there for years, who did enormous damage to the United States of America and its security. We're going to ask George Mashke when we get back in a few minutes just exactly whether or not this gentleman was given polygraphs in order to assure his superiors that he was telling the truth and an honest employee. Ironically, George is a man who was denied employment by the FBI due to what he says, and what I believe probably is quite true, a fallacious polygraph test. So in one case, a man who could have helped us doesn't get that chance. In the other case, a man who was harming us for years did get that chance. It really makes you think. And we're going to also ask him, since he was an interrogator, what kind of techniques work? How can we find out who the good guys are and who the bad guys are in this immense organization that is so, we are all so reliant on, and that it is so important that it be honest, and goodness knows it's not in so many cases, as we all know, but that at least it be able to maintain security successfully. My first nonfiction book about the close encounter experience in, I think, maybe 15 years, is coming out on January the 5th. It's called Solving the Communion Enigma. And I have waited this long to write it. In fact, I've been working on it pretty steadily for the past 10 years, although it's not, as you might think from hearing that, 3,000 pages long by any means. What I've been working on is doing research so that when I did come back to this in nonfiction, I could come back with some answers and some truly new ideas. That one of the most extraordinary ideas, which we get into in the book, started with Ann Streber and her reading of the thousands upon thousands of letters that we were receiving from many of you about your own close encounters, and she discovered an amazing secret. The first four chapters are available to listen to for unknowncountry.com subscribers. So if you are a subscriber, you can listen to the first four chapters of Solving the Communion Enigma, to my reading of them. Also, 50 free copies are going to be given to subscribers, and the coupon is going to be in the next unknowncountry.com subscriber bulletin. Now, when we get back, we're going to go deeper into this issue of polygraphs, an issue that you notice is almost entirely ignored because of the vast extent of the use of polygraphs and the reliance on them. But we are way out on a limb with this technology. And when we get back, George Mashke is going to tell us more about just how far out we really are. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. We're back with George Mashke talking about polygraphs. George's website is antipolygraph.org. His book is The Lie Behind the Lie Detector. His free ebook, you can get it on antipolygraph.org. You can also click through from the carousel on coasttocoastam.com as always. George, you're scaring me. You've told us that the people at the top, the people in the most sensitive positions, are the ones who get polygraphs, and they are the ones who are the most, who know the secrets. And now, there was a man in the FBI discovered a few years ago who had been a double agent for years. Do you remember this story?
Yes, the double agent you're thinking of is Robert Hansen.
That's correct, Robert Hansen.
Who worked in counterintelligence, and he basically gave away the store to the Russians. However, this is not the polygraph's fault. He was never polygraphed. And actually, as a result of that, what the FBI started doing after he was arrested was stepping up their use of polygraphs on current FBI employees. You see, when Hansen joined the FBI, it wasn't required to take a polygraph test to join. The first FBI director was very, J. Edgar Hoover, was very skeptical of the polygraph, and for good reason, because the first time the FBI used the polygraph in an espionage investigation, it was in 1938, they were questioning a suspected German spy, and he succeeded in convincing the polygraph operator that he was cooperating and being truthful, and so they relaxed their surveillance of him, and he escaped on the first ship to Germany. And so that the polygraph really sort of sabotaged that espionage case.
Now, what is the history of the polygraph? How did it originate?
Well, it started, I suppose its earliest roots in the United States could be traced back to the cartoonist who created the character Wonder Woman, William Moulton Marston, who had an idea while he was a student at Harvard University studying psychology and law, that he could detect deception by measuring a person's heart rate while they were asking them questions. He used a blood pressure cuff to measure pressure and heart rate. And he published his findings, and that caught the attention of a student at the University of Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley, who was also a police officer in the Berkeley Police Department, named John Larson. And he devised an instrument that combined measuring blood pressure and heart rate, along with a person's breathing, and recorded that information on a chart. So this was the first polygraph. That was back in 1921, and it took off from there, first adopted by the Berkeley Police Department, which was considered a progressive one in law enforcement in the day. And Larson had a protege named Leonard Keeler, who developed the first instrument that is really like the polygraph that we would recognize today, that measures breathing, heart rate, as well as skin conductance or resistance, which is a function of perspiration.
Now, so Keeler
actually has a patent for the polygraph, but he didn't actually invent the instruments, but he combined them all in a single instrument that polygraph operators could use to do their interrogations, and he started the first polygraph school, the Keeler Polygraph Institute, in Chicago, Illinois. And it took off from there. Police departments across the country got interested in this. The press reported about it uncritically, and so very soon a myth of the lie detector was built up. And of course, a procedure doesn't have to have validity to have some utility. That is, if dumb crooks think that the lie detector works and then they're duped into believing that they've been caught, sometimes they confess. So there would be a string of stories about liars caught by the polygraph who then confessed.
But there must have also been innocent people who were caught by the polygraph who then confessed, because we now know that confession can be coerced even in the innocent.
Well, yes, and in fact, misplaced reliance on the polygraph has often led to coerced false confessions, because, you know, investigators who naively believe in the lie detector think, okay, this is our man, now let's get to confession, after he fails a polygraph test. But that's not, you know, a rational conclusion. In fact, in a statistical analysis performed by Dr. Helen Zelikoff of the best field studies of calligraphy suggest that if a person is telling the truth, they have roughly a 50-50 chance of passing the polygraph.
Oh, well, good. So, 50-50 chance. This is wonderful. Just random, almost.
Yeah. The polygraph has not been proven to reliably work better than chance under field conditions. And that's a fact that you won't hear from the polygraph operators.
Now, George, how are U.S. intelligence agencies using the polygraph?
Well, the one big way is to screen prospective employees. There's an interesting thing there. The failure rates depend a lot on whether you're applying to be hired or whether you're already hired. For example, agencies like the FBI and CIA have a polygraph failure rate for applicants on the order of 50%. It's hard to imagine that people who make it as far along in the hiring process as to get to the polygraph, that half of them would be liars. But that's what the polygraph is saying. And I think part of the reason for that is that they know they can get away with it. So they use it. It can also be used in that sense as an arbitrary way of getting rid of someone who, for whatever subjective reason, in the polygraph operator's mind, doesn't fit the mold.
Perhaps in his boss's mind. In other words, could a polygraph operator be told to get rid of somebody?
Yes. There appears to be a case where that has been alleged within the CIA, where a CIA attorney, internal CIA documents that were released in the context of a lawsuit suggest that the polygraph was used as a pretext to get rid of him. But the point I want to make is there's the pre-employment screening, and then there's the screening of employees. And once you're already hired, they can't afford to be failing half of the people who are already hired. So then your chances of passing are quite good. But it still ends up destroying careers. Recently, there was an FBI agent, in the aftermath of the Hansen arrest, I mentioned to you that the FBI stepped up its reliance on the polygraph. FBI agent in California named Rita Chang had her career ruined because of failure to pass the polygraph screening test, although she hasn't been charged or found guilty of actually doing anything wrong. Just failure to pass the polygraph was enough to ruin her career.
Well, George, I want to ask you, you say that you've been an interrogator. How do you do it?
Mm-hmm. How do you tell whether or not somebody's lying? Yeah.
You said you don't use body language, so what do you use?
Right. Well, what you can use is facts and information. I was a Army interrogator, so I wasn't questioning suspected criminals. And I did my questioning of debriefing intelligence sources, people who came from other countries with information that was of interest to the U.S. Army.
So you needed to know if this was disinformation or real information.
Right. And so what we do is check what was being, the information that was being provided to us against known facts. And that's a good way of checking.
So that's easier.
Credibility.
I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, there's no magic bullet. There's body language is not reliable. The polygraph is certainly not reliable. But checking what's been told against what's known is the one real check that you have regarding the truthfulness of an information source.
Well, I remember once reading that when someone is lying to you, they tend to look up and to the left. And
yeah, that's nonsense.
Well, you know,
Neuro-linguistic programming, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. But, and of course, when they're facing you, it looks like they're looking to the right. But interestingly enough, I have talked with someone who kept doing that, and I knew this person was lying.
Yeah, that's right. We were both aware of that.
And yes.
We knew for certain that they were lying, and they kept looking up and said, maybe it's not nonsense.
But you see, anecdotal evidence like that is not proof that the technique has any validity.
Oh, absolutely not. We're agreeing with you. You understand, George, here.
Codified conjecture is what this neuro-linguistic programming is. And in any event, if a clever spy or criminal knew that his interrogator believed in this, then he could...
He would keep his eyes down.
Doing those gestures, because right. That's publicly available. In fact, I was appalled when this neuro-linguistic programming technique was actually taught at an interrogation course that some of the members of my unit were sent to.
Well, of course you would be if you... Yeah. Let me ask you this, George. Say a foreign agent desires, or not a foreign agent, perhaps a member of a criminal gang or on the mafia or something, desires to become an FBI employee. Would there be any way for him to learn how to be certain to pass the polygraph?
No, you can't be certain that you'll pass it, but there are techniques that you can use to increase your likelihood of passing it, in fact, to greatly increase your likelihood of passing it. And that involves what are called countermeasures to the polygraph. As I explained to you earlier, there are the relevant questions, which in the context of pre-employment screening involve questions like, did you ever release classified information to any unauthorized person? Did you ever have unauthorized contact with a foreign government? And did anyone direct you to seek FBI employment? So those are the relevant questions. And common control questions that they might ask to compare with those would be, did you ever lie to get out of trouble? Did you ever lie to a loved one? And so the way to pass is to make sure that your reactions to those control questions are stronger than your reactions to the relevant questions. And that can be done covertly in ways that the polygraph operator cannot detect, such as solving a math problem as quickly as you can in your head when you're asked the control question, the question about lying to a loved one or lying to get out of trouble. Anything to heighten that will tend to heighten your lability, the amount that you perspire. Your breathing may be suspended briefly, and it can result in changes in heart rate too. All of which show up as scorable reactions on the polygraph and make it look like you're more concerned about that question about lying to a loved one than. About whether anyone has directed you to seek FBI employment.
What about taking tranquilizers to keep your heart rate down and things like that?
Well, not really, because the key to passing it's not to show no reaction at all, but you've got to show stronger reactions to the control questions than to the relevant questions. And if you take a tranquilizer, that might reduce your reactivity overall. But again, the key to passing is not to show no reaction, but to show stronger reactions to the control question.
One of the polygraph operators who gave me a polygraph wanted to see the inside of my shoes to be sure that I didn't have a tack in my shoe that I would use to somehow fool the polygraph. Well, we're coming up on the
most famous old countermeasure in the book is to put a tack in your shoe, and then when asked certain questions, like those control questions, press your toe against the tack.
Right.
But it's not a very good countermeasure because, well, as your polygraph operator did, they can ask to inspect your shoes.
Okay, we are going to be coming up on the top of the hour. And when we get back, we're going to open the phones. This is Whitley Strieber sitting in for George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM.